Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of a week has it been in Lake Wobegon? If you take auto mechanic Clint Bunsen as an example, it has been un poquito loco, to say the least. Faced with a fading marriage, failing business, and an alarming health issue, the hero of the newest Lake Wobegon novel gets some stunning news from a recommended DNA test. He is nearly half Spanish. So what is a formerly stoic Norwegian to do with all that pent-up Latin passion? Garrison Keillor is here to talk about it. He is the producer and host of A Prairie Home Companion on public radio, a syndicated columnist, and of course, an author. The latest book is called Liberty, a novel of Lake Wobegon, and Garrison Keillor is in town to speak tonight at the Unity Church on Forest Lane in Dallas. Garrison, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you.
So we haven't heard a lot of stories about Clint Bunsen in the past. How did you decide that he would be the one for this new book?
He was a staunch member of the community. He was a father of three and on the board of the Lutheran Church and a loyal Republican and the mechanic, an auto mechanic, so a necessary person. And he is overwhelmed by a wave of restlessness and a sort of regret about a wrong turn that he took. And then this DNA test, you know, which surprises him. But the problems of a 60-year-old man are mostly self-inflicted. And this is comedy. This is not tragedy. So,
how much do you have to keep track of your characters, because they come up during the radio program and in the novels? Do you have a schematic somewhere to make sure that you never contradict yourself, or is that something you don't worry about?
I should, and I don't know why I don't. It's one of the things I wonder why I never did. Every so often I make a mistake. The name of Carl Krebsbach's wife always escapes me, and I just can't remember. I don't think it's Margie. I think Margie is married to his brother-in-law, Lyle Jansky, and so I'm left trying to think of Carl's wife. And if I said Margie, I would get letters from listeners who would say, well, you know, when was the divorce? Who's this? But I do my best. That's all I can say. Short-term memory loss, you know, it works well for some things and not so well for others.
How real are these characters to you? Or are they entirely something that you feel like you play with?
I can play with them. I have fun with them. I don't take fiction as seriously as I did when I was your age. And, you know, I was out to write the great American novel. I gave that up in, when was it? 1988. Now I'm just out to write the comic novel, which is a short, compact novel in which you take a good man like Clint Bunsen and you get him into trouble, his own trouble, and see what happens to him. It's the first book I ever wrote in which a woman takes a gun in her own hand. I don't know why I never did that before. Irene Bunsen, the wife of Clint, holds a pistol in her hand. It was quite exciting to write that. I come from, you know, Minnesota. Women don't ordinarily walk around with pistols, at least the women's I know.
Shotguns, more likely?
No. So it was quite an adventure. And suddenly there she is, and she has it in her hand, and she sort of aims it around a little bit. Makes her feel good, too.
To have that power.
Yes.
Did it feel like a sacrifice for you to decide in 1988, okay, I am not the man that is going to write the next great American novel?
No. I was glad to leave that to Philip Roth and Joyce Carol Oates and John Updike and move on and do other things and write things to amuse people. This is the second book in a series of short comic novels. I'm going to see how this goes. The first one was Pontoon last year, and this year is Liberty, and next year is Pilgrims, three little novels that sort of come in a series.
One of the things that people may not know about you, I don't think we run it on this program, is you do for American Public Media a poetry reading. Is it every day?
It is. It's called Writer's Almanac. It's a little five minute show, and it has some historical events. You know, it was on this day in 1893, the first woman who went over Niagara Falls in a barrel went over, and then I read a poem.
Do you choose different kinds of poems for that than you might read yourself for pleasure, knowing that your audience may not come to this with a great love of poetry?
No, I take pleasure in the poems. The poems are always poems that are absolutely straight, even if they are symbolist poems or imagistic poems. They are poems that somebody frying eggs and bacon with children tugging at your pant leg can get in one listening. No smoke, no...
As opposed to needing to go back and hear it again.
No need for that. I don't blow smoke at people. I try not to.
Given that you've worked in radio for so long, obviously you write for the ear. You're a fan of poetry. Are there novelists that you read more for the way the words sound in your mouth or in your head when you imagine them than for structure or plot or characters?
I've become I've become a very poor reader, I must admit, over, I don't know, the last 5 or 10 years. I don't know why. I read now and then. I review books now and then. And, of course, I read those books. And I read the books of my friends. But I seem to be at an age when I am more aware of time passing. And I become a very intolerant reader. I go into a bookstore. I open a book. I read the first page, I turn the page, I read the second page.
If you're not caught, that's it.
That's it. Mm-hmm. I didn't used to be that way.
Did you used to force yourself through something you didn't like?
You mean writing?
Reading.
No, I can't read something that I don't like. I just don't have the time for it anymore. I mean, there's a time in life, you know, when you're in your 30s and you're, you know, life is eternal and you have all sorts of time. But right now, my time is more, you know, compressed and dedicated to writing and, you know, running around the yard with a 10-year-old kid and going off to see movies and that sort of thing.
So did you used to force yourself, or do you now force yourself to move past writing that you started that you're not crazy about? But is there a point at which you think, okay, if I can just get past this, I'll be able to go back and fix what I don't want?
I abandon projects much more easily now and just dump them. I wrote about 100 pages of a play, and then I sat down one day and I read it, and I threw it away. No regret.
What do you think it is about this little town that you've created that people are so obsessed with, including people who have no connection whatsoever to that sort of life?
They're not obsessed. People like to hear stories. They like to hear the human voice. And this has always been a staple of radio. It's the reason for Rush. It's the reason for Howard Stern. It's the reason for most shows, I think, that people become attached to. They like to be talked to. And they like to be told stories. So I don't think it has anything to do with the Midwest, really, or small-town values, or, you know, their interest in Minnesota. I think it has very little to do with Minnesota. It has to do with the fact that people like to be talked to. I love to be talked to.
I guess my next question was going to be whether or not there was a difference in the way people process the stories based on whether or not they do think to themselves, oh, I remember, you know, bringing hot dish to the church supper, as opposed to the people who have grown up in cities and just imagine this completely out of whole cloth.
I think that it's much more persuasive to people who've grown up in cities. I think that anyone who grew up in Minnesota is apt to be more intolerant of some of the details and to think, well, now that would never have happened. And, you know, if he said that, why didn't he think to say this? You know, and why isn't this true? Whereas someone who grew up on Long Island, somebody who grew up in California, I just think to audiences that that seemed to lean forward when I stood on stage and told the news from Lake Wobegon. I think of Seattle and San Francisco, and I think of the Houston Opera House, and I think of Dallas, and a long time ago we did a show in Dallas, and New York, surprisingly, this audience in Midtown Manhattan, and you start telling them about Norwegian bachelor farmers, and they all perk up their ears.
What was it about Dallas the last time you were here to speak that made you think that you'd found a place where you understood the kind of people who embrace torture?
Embrace torture? I don't know. That was a long stretch, but I do think that we are responsible for the leaders whom we elect, and I feel desperately sorrowful that the United States has embraced torture and has turned its back on the Geneva Accord.
Specifically, though, you know, you wrote a column. You don't do this after you leave every city. You wrote a column and really described having been in Dallas and been sort of moved around by burly security guards and told not to discuss politics.
Right. I simply was telling what had happened to me.
Yeah. Are there places in the country that feel very different to you in terms of the way people respond to you and respond to the program and to your views?
No. No, I don't see that. I don't see that, really. I mean, the audience for the radio show to me seems like a single audience, and whether they live in Dallas or whether they live in Seattle or New York, to me they're one audience.
Are they the same as the audience that reads the books? Because I would imagine some people come to the novels and think, oh, there's sex in this, and I just can't believe that nice man from the radio described sex.
Well, it's a story similar to stories I've told on the radio, but of course on the radio, I would never tell it, in the sort of explicit detail in which it appears in print. But a writer of a novel who pulls his punches is cheating the reader, and to deal in euphemism is a gyp on the reader, and I've come slowly to that conclusion, but forcefully.
Is it any more difficult for you, or was it any more difficult for you early on to predict what people would find really funny, as compared with what you find funny that you put in your work?
It still mystifies me, and ever so often in front of an audience, there's an enormous surprise, and you come out with a big laugh line, and it's like stepping off the porch onto a step that is not there. It just is a kind of a lurch out into space, and the audience can tell that you expected them to laugh, but you just go on. And of course, there also are these big bursts of laughter, and you're not sure what. You know, you look down at your fly, you look at your shoes, you know, what did I do, what did I say? It's a surprising thing. And of course writing a book like this, you have no idea, none whatsoever. I don't sit and laugh at what I write.
Garrison Keillor is my guest. The new novel is called Liberty. He'll be appearing tonight at the Unity Church on Forest Lane in Dallas. You can join our conversation after the break. Get on the line now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Garrison Keillor is here. He is a novelist, humorist, and musician. He is host and producer of Prairie Home Companion on NPR. His new book is called Liberty, a novel of Lake Wobegon, and he'll be appearing tonight at the Unity Church in Dallas. You can find information about that on our website, the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org. You've said before that you are a perfectionist, and I have to imagine that that makes it really maddening to work on a live two-hour show where timing is critical, where you have a lot of human beings that you're counting on. Are you better at coping with the frustration than you used to be?
I don't feel the frustration. Once you go on the air, it's just kind of like going down a ski slope, just as a steady ride, and you're just doing your best, the best that you can. You can be a perfectionist as a writer, and much of the show is written, and you keep working and working and working at it. But then once it gets going, there's just a big whoosh. Whereas if I did a studio show, if I tried to do this in a studio, I would spend the entire week on it. You'd be able to bring your neurotic perfectionism to bear, and it would drive you crazy. You'd wear yourself out, and the show would fall of sheer exhaustion in a few years. So being a live show is a way to defeat your perfectionism. You can be a perfectionist up to a point, and then you just have to go with what happens, realizing that oftentimes a big mistake is the best thing that can happen to you.
Because you have to respond to it. Yeah.
The audience loves mistakes. They love it when you drop your microphone and things go wrong.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. First on the line, we have Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Hi. Wondered this for years. Mr. Keillor, what is your sense of your role as a singer on that show? To my knowledge, and I apologize if I'm wrong, I've never seen you sing on like Letterman or take it seriously as a role, but you sing as much as, say, Bing Crosby did on his old show in the 40s. And so I was wondering what your sense of it is as a performer, whether how your sort of attitude toward it is. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
I sing because I love to sing, and I've been singing since I was a child. I grew up in a fundamentalist sect in which we did not use pianos or organs, and so we sang a cappella. I sing because I think the host of the show ought to sing and subject himself to danger along with everybody else. If I was invited to sing on Letterman's show, I would. I sang once on Letterman's show years and years and years ago. They haven't invited me back. Maybe that's why. I don't know. It doesn't really matter to me. I sing because I love to.
Who was the best storyteller in your life when you were a kid?
Well, my Uncle Lou Powell was. He was a salesman, so he had this gift of gab. The rest of us did not. We were quiet, self-effacing people. But he had real social skills, and he was my great-uncle, actually. And so his memory went way, way back. And he could tell stories about people who had died a long time ago, and that fascinated me. And he loved to tell stories about catastrophes. There were two house fires in family history, and he could describe them in great detail. And I loved that.
What kind of audience are you now when someone is telling a story or when you're watching something?
I'm a reverent audience. I am a very quiet, reverent audience. I'm not a good audience for people who are doing comedy. I don't laugh at jokes. I listen to jokes and I sort of judge them professionally. And I'd be glad to hold up numbers, 8.5, 8.7, but I don't actually laugh. I rarely laugh. But no, I'm a good audience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email from Paul in Dallas who says, a long time ago, I visited a small place in Wisconsin by the name of Lake Nebagamon. Did that town influence the naming of Lake Wobegon?
No. Wobegon, of course, comes from the English word, which means bedraggled, and I picked it out because it sounds like an Indian name. Minnesota is full of Indian place names. After we drove them out, we honored them using their names. But using the Indian names, you see, was a way for people to disguise the ethnic makeup of a town, a town that was, you know, all German or all Swedish or Norwegian would disguise itself, and that was my purpose too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next up, we have Maggie in Fort Worth. Hey, Maggie.
Hello. I've been listening to Prairie Home Companion for years and years, and I just wanted to say that it was a revelation. I grew up in a Norwegian community north of Seattle, and until I heard that program, I was like the fish in the water, but I didn't recognize the water. The stories you would tell and the things you would describe that I did or my family did, I thought, everybody doesn't do that, you know, or I recognize the roots of things. I just found it miraculous to see myself from the outside that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I was interested in your remarks on poetry, and I wonder, how old were your children, or do you still read poetry to your children? I've found the pleasure in poetry is not just in reading to small children, but as they get older, they understand more, and that's one of the wonderful things to it. Do you still read to yours?
I don't read poetry to my kids. I don't read to my kids. I talk to them, and I make up stories with them, and I like to play rhyming games with my daughter. She's 10 years old. And just out of whatever you see around you, you can make a little rhyming game and play with words. And she loves that. So that more than reciting poetry to her is what I do.
Does having a child that young, and you're in your mid-60s, is that right?
I am, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Does having a child that young make you feel really connected to, people that the ages of her friends' parents, or does it make you feel like really notice the difference?
No, I'm very odd when I go to school for school events, and all of these parents are there in their 30s, and, you know, I just sort of hang back in the shadows, and they, you know, they wonder who I am, they mistake me for a grandfather, which is logical. But that's not a problem. The beauty of having a little girl when you're my age is that you have this joyful presence in your life. This kid who bounces up and down and laughs. Every day is a great day. When you're 10 years old, she still is affectionate, and she throws her arms around you, and she sings, and, you know, big high highs, and, you know, then she cries, you know, and then she'll be back up. It's a beautiful life when you're 10, and adolescence has not wrapped its arms around her yet. She still loves her parents.
Are you dreading that moment?
Well, yes, of course. I'm very fearful for my child. I think that's my role to be. The life of parents is a life of paranoia and constant prayer. But I hope for the best.
We have an email from Mark who says earlier this year he read the biography of Charles Schulz, and he said there are many things about that childhood that reminded him of Lake Wobegon, things like being taught you're no better than anyone else, playing down any accomplishment, and hiding anything that indicated higher education or sophistication. He was wondering whether or not you have any comments on the background of your famous fellow Minnesotan.
He was a great comic artist, and we revere him in Minnesota, even as we are a little abashed at how poorly he was treated. He was turned down by the St. Paul paper. Peanuts was rejected there in my hometown. And he grew up. It's a terrific biography. I really recommend that book. He grew up among very, very hard Norwegians on his mother's side, sarcastic, dark people who were belittling and who disciplined children through humiliation. And there's nothing handsome or funny about that. His mother he dearly loved, but still there was that fear of being put down. He was an oddball in high school and an oddball in St. Paul. He went off into the army and that was good for him, but then he had to come back and deal with his culture, which is a self-effacing culture. Don't think you're somebody. Don't think you're better than other people. Hide your accomplishments and so forth. And it was liberating for him to go off to California, to San Francisco, and then to Santa Rosa. And we don't begrudge him that. he was a great man, Charles Schulz. And he drew his own strip, and drew it beautifully, right up until the very end when he got so sick and his hand was no longer steady, and he stepped down.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Garrison Keillor is with us today. Let's go next to Henry in Dallas. Hello, Henry.
Hello. Mr. Keillor, I've enjoyed your work for a long, long time. And recently, in fact, quite recently, I enjoyed your review in the New York Times of Julian Barnes' book.
Yes, sir.
And he expressed, as I recall, a real anxiety about his belief in extinction, which means, as I read it, no belief in afterlife.
Yes.
And I wondered, is it too personal for me to ask your views on that subject?
No, it's not too personal at all. I believe in an afterlife. On my better days, I believe in an afterlife. But I would be dishonest if I didn't tell you that there were days, some of them Sundays, you know, when I don't. I don't seem to. I don't know. You know, as Scripture says, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. And so I keep going to the Episcopal Church down the block, and I like to do that, and I keep searching for my belief, and I find it, and then if it's missing the next day, I have faith that my faith will return.
Is the appeal of the church as much about the ritual as about what you take from it in terms of theology?
A great deal of it is ritual. I grew up in a fundamentalist group in which they had abandoned the ritual of the church. They had revolted against the Anglican rite, and I find myself drawn towards it. I find myself drawn towards the prayers that we all say together, and I'm irked by the organ, which is too loud, and oftentimes I'm irked by the sermon, but I am never irked by us singing the psalm in Episcopal plain chant. I find that to be the most moving thing, and also the prayers of the people when we kneel down on the kneeler and we pray in order, you know, for the leaders of the world and for peace in the world, and for those who are ill and who are in need, and for ourselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sam in Grand Prairie. Hi, Sam.
Hey. Hi, Garrison. I love your show.
Thank
you,
sir.
I had a question. You were, I heard it mentioned that you were half Spanish. Like, how, like, you're from, like, when you say Spanish, you mean from Spain, right? Spaniard?
Well, this is actually a character in my book. I mean, I may wish that I were half Hispanic, but that's for a character. That's a character in my book. It's not me, I'm afraid. I am English. I'm Anglo from Yorkshire, from the moors of Yorkshire and Scots from Glasgow.
Do people assume sometimes that you are Norwegian based on, certainly not your name, but on the content of the show?
People do. People do sometimes assume that, and I'm honored, of course, but it's not true.
Mm-hmm. When you are imagining your characters, do you find that the point that you're at in your life makes it harder to go back and realistically do, you know, a 25-year-old man and the things he's struggling with? Or having lived through that, does that continue to resound with you?
I can easily do a 25-year-old man. I'm less confident about doing a 25-year-old woman, but I would still try. I wouldn't shy away from it. I'm pretty confident about doing an early teenager, not so confident about doing, you know, mid or late teens. And people my age, I think I've got that down.
How different is it for you to write for a woman? Is it more of a struggle when you think about language and dialogue, or is it just an issue of sort of really putting yourself inside of their head?
It is a struggle, of course, but the struggle is mostly, I think, in the details. That's where you would trip up. But I believe that down deep, there is just a great commonality, certain women are more like certain other men than they are like other women. I just don't think there's much you can generalize about by way of gender. I believe the same about race.
Let's go next to Todd in Louisville. Hello, Todd.
Hello, Garrison.
Yes, sir.
Great to hear you on the radio and in person here. I look forward to seeing you tonight. I'd like to just ask you, you know, as a man of arts and letters and spent your time pontificating on various things, what is your least favorite word?
My least favorite word? Well, senior, I guess, now that I'm that age. The term senior moment always kind of makes me twitch. Jargon, you know, bureaucratic jargon that crops up in people's memos, buzzwords. I am so far away from that world that it's always a shock to me when I hear it.
There's a lot going on during election season when it comes to buzzwords.
Yes.
My guest is Garrison Keillor. His new book is called Liberty, A Novel of Lake Wobegon. He's in town to appear tonight at the Unity Church in Dallas on Forest Lane. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org, or you can go to unitydallas.org. We'll be back in a moment, and if you want to get on the line to ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Garrison Keillor. He's the producer and host of A Prairie Home Companion, and his new book is called Liberty, A Novel of Lake Wobegon. He'll appear at the Unity Church in Dallas this evening. We have an email here with no name signed at the bottom. It says, because it's radio, we can't see if you all dance during the Powder Milk song, etc. Do you?
Sometimes. Depends on who's on stage with me. I don't like to dance alone, but if Geraldine Steele is on stage, I almost always dance with Geraldine. She's a very bouncy, vivacious person. But usually, no. If I'm there by myself, no, I would not. I'm not an exhibitionist.
What's the difference for you between a show that you think is really a great one and one that doesn't please you?
Well, little mistakes don't bother me so much. What bothers me is a kind of a leaden feeling, a kind of a rote feeling. What bothers me is indifference, really, and more and more as I get older. I think somebody else said this, but the difference, the opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is indifference, and a show that feels indifferent to me, I just feel sheepish about, I feel guilty about. I suppose it's inevitable if you do so many shows that every so often there will be one that just seems to be phoned in, but I feel terrible about it.
Is it, you know, like people who are sports fans and they go home and for the next several days they're just in a really bad mood?
No, it usually passes for me on Sunday. I get over it pretty quickly. I usually feel bad. Even if it's a good show, I feel bad on Saturday night. And so I go home, and my wife and I sit, and we talk about something else. And then I get up in the morning. If I'm in St. Paul, I go to church. And usually Sunday, I forget about it.
Do you remember all the details of a show, or do people say, I heard that thing in the second hour, and you have to really strain to remember what that was?
I remember it. I remember it for a while. But radio is kind of self-erasing. That's the beauty of it. It fades as you get to work on the next week's show. Today is Tuesday, and I'm working on next Saturday. I won't really start working hard on it until Thursday. So I'd say around Wednesday or Thursday, I'll forget most of what happened last Saturday. Old Crow Medicine Show and Maria Jetty and all of those.
We have a couple questions here about how the show is written. One is, do you write the news from Lake Wobegon each week, or do you wing it? And another is how all the other stories get written.
I do notes for the news from Lake Wobegon, but I don't want to have a script or anything that looks like a script. I want to go out with a lot of stuff in my head and sort of find my way through it. I'd like if I have a clear idea for a story. But I don't want a script. I don't want to worry about that. The other things, the scripts, of course, the Guy Noir, Private Eye, and the Lives of the Cowboys, Dusty and Lefty, and those are written, and the actors hold them in their hands out on stage, and the sound effects man has it on his music stand there while he's doing the coconut shells and the door opening and closing and the ringing telephones, and so forth.
How do you think of your talent for making up stories? Because, there are many people who can't imagine doing that. Does it feel for you like another sense that you have that other people, some have and some don't?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a matter of paying attention. That really is all it is. And you pick up little bits of things in the course of a week. And they kind of jump out at you. And you put these elements together in your own mind, or maybe you put them together on a page, and they start to have a relationship to each other. I mean, if I go back over just this morning, I could come up with several story elements. I could start with a woman in the airport who had a child in a little papoose harness, and then was pushing twins in a stroller and getting on the airplane and men passing her carrying briefcases. I could put that scene into a story, and then I could put that in together with my hotel room in Dallas, which is the first hotel room I've ever had in my life that had a pool table in it. And between that mother, the three kids, the men with the briefcases, the pool table, and two or three other things, you could have a story.
Garrison Keillor is my guest. Our number is 800-933-5372. Next on the line is Dave in Fort Worth. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Ms. Keillor. You're a national treasure and a personal hero, without a doubt. I was well into doing similar things with writing and working with radio and such, and got talked out of it in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. You, however, jumped right in and did it. Have you ever, were you professionally trained as a disc jockey or storyteller, or how did you become familiar with the art of how to get it out there on the airwaves?
I just sat in a studio and did it, starting when I was 18 at the University of Minnesota. I started out in radio, and I went on to the university's educational station, and then I jumped to Minnesota Public Radio, where I've been since the late 60s, off and on. And I just did it. Broadcasting school gives you certain skills that may be useful temporarily, but they don't train you to talk. You have to take that out of your own experience and your own impulse. I don't know of any training in communications or speech or broadcast school that's going to prepare you to do that. You just have to find a place to start out where it doesn't matter that much if you make mistakes. And that's one of the problems with public radio nowadays, is that it's become so slick and so professional that it's no longer a place for people to start out. So you may have to, you know, you may have to start out doing a podcast. You may have to start out doing something at some low frequency neighborhood radio station or community radio or something. But you have to find a place to start.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to James in Louisville. Hello, James.
Yes. Mr. Keeler, I've been a fan of yours since the early, late 70s. I moved from Iowa to Inver Grove Heights, and Prairie Home Companion was on the morning at that time. Great times. And later on, I was lucky enough to attend your lunchtime essays at the St. Paul Library. And some of those were fantastic, and especially your recounting your how you got into radio as a result of your mother taking you for swimming lessons, and you skipped out after the first one. So it was very enjoyable.
Thank you, sir.
And you were going to ask a question, James, about older stories?
Well, yeah, I've heard lots of reasons since that about how you got into radio, but I guess I've never heard that one replayed. Is that documented someplace?
That's in a story that's collected in a book called Happy to Be Here. It's called Drowning, 1954, and it's a true story. I'm not sure it's how I got into radio, but it's how I got interested in writing, and by skipping out on swimming lessons at the YMCA and going to the Minneapolis Public Library. I have a lot of stories made up about getting into radio. And if you want to hear the true one, I'm always happy to tell you. But or I can make one up, too.
Kind of like Meatloaf and his origins, right?
Right, exactly.
It's, you know, some writers who are very gifted will still say the process feels excruciating much of the time. Is it that way for you?
No, it's not. It's not. I don't know what they're talking about. I think that writing is painful if you are trying to do something that you can't do. But to sit down and write fiction, no. Writers talk about the pain of writing in order to give themselves stature. It's a form of boasting. So it's a form of bragging. Dentists don't stand around at parties and complain about how hard, you know, it is to stand and look down into people's mouths. And but I mean, they could, you know. They could, but who's interested? I'm not. And I'm not. I'm even less interested in the complaints of writers. You know, give me a break. If it's that hard, don't do it.
I know that you're obviously very politically active, which means that you consume a lot of news. Is there any good writing anywhere in the media that you find?
I find it all over, and I find it online. I think that when you scout around online and you look at blogs, all kinds of blogs, you find a kind of a wonderful wild writing about politics. It's very funny and very sometimes profane, but very flamboyant, that I love. I just love. And when you read it online, then you see why newspapers are dying in America. It's because the writing online is more interesting. It's just more fun to read, that's all. Newspapers were taken over by bookkeepers and accountants, you know, long ago. And they've been managed to death. And if they die, they deserve to die. They're just not offering what readers need.
Lots of people have predicted multiple times that radio could not possibly survive the next big thing, and yet it seems to be as robust as it was in the 20s. Why do you think that is?
The Internet has been good, very, very good for radio. It's been amazing for radio. And if you do something original and odd and offbeat in radio, and things that are absolutely local are by definition offbeat. You will be picked up all over by people, and whatever you do in radio can be archived, can be accessed by people, you know, for months, years to come, online. It's given a whole new break to radio. It hasn't been all that interesting for TV. YouTube, you know, can take, you know, 4 or 5 minutes of something and and show it to you. And YouTube is mostly interesting for oddities, and it's kind of a freak show. But it's been wonderful, wonderful for radio.
Certainly, as the author of the Lake Wobegon books, and I know that you write other things as well, you are the narrator. You're completely in charge of everything. Your presence on the radio show is largely as sort of this avuncular figure who knows everything that's going on and controls
avuncular
everything.
Is the very word I was thinking. It was going
that's
through
your
my,
least favorite word?
It was going through my mind at the very same time. No, I don't mind avuncular at all.
I'm wondering if people often come up to you and sort of expect you to dispense some good old-fashioned wisdom to them that you don't necessarily feel prepared to dispense.
What do you want to know, dear? Just ask me. Just what would you like? You need advice, what, career or
how often
child
does it
rearing?
Happen?
Or, huh?
Yeah, tell me how to raise my kids.
How often does it happen? Well, when I go off on a book tour, people stand in line, and I stand there, and they walk up to me. And sometimes they will say, I'm a writer. I've been working on something. What are you working on? Well, working on some stories. Oh, yeah, oh, really? What are those about? And we get into a little bit of a conversation. And if they want advice, I'll give them advice. I'll give them straight advice.
I have to tell you, there's a very sweet story that our producer has told me, Jeff Whittington, that when he was 19 years old, this was years and years ago, he was a young musician, and he said he approached you after an appearance somewhere, and he said you were could not have been nicer as he talked to you about his interest in music.
I could have been nicer. I could have been much nicer. I could have offered him a job or something. I could have done a lot more, and I've been kicking myself ever since.
Well, he's done all right for himself.
Well, okay. I hope so. My advice to writers is that writing is a job. Writing is work. It's hard work, and it requires preparation. Like anything else, you have to learn how to do it. And you learn how to do it by doing it, and also by reading writers whom you admire and imitating them. And you go to work in the morning the same as you'd go to work at any other job. And you sit down, and you put your skinny seat down on the chair, and you write.
Do you tend to think about the same thing every night as you fall asleep?
No, I used to. I used to have a sort of a image in my mind of a beach in California, and I could always put myself to sleep by walking down the path through the weeds down to the beach, and I would lie down on the sand, and then I'd fall asleep.
Garrison Keillor has been my guest this hour. The new book is called Liberty, A Novel of Lake Wobegon. He will appear tonight at Unity Church in Dallas. You can find information about that on our website. Garrison, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so
much. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.